BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, welcome to 5 Live Science. I'm Chris Smith from The Naked Scientist. And in the programme this week, how close are we to being able to grow complete new arms and legs? New research looks very promising in that direction. Speaking of growing, find out how you can grow your own water filtration system at home and a breakthrough in sight restoration. We take a look at the patient who has received a bionic eye. Plus,
I realised that sort of my smell and taste had departed. And I'd kind of hang on to the hope of the 6 to 8 weeks that everybody was telling me that it would bounce back. But as I've gone past each milestone, actually, it's now 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, and I'm kind of 2 weeks away from it being a year.
In the wake of COVID-19, millions of people have suffered smell and taste loss. For some, it's never returned. Others are left in a world that doesn't smell or taste quite right. So how can we help them?
The Naked Scientists on 5 Live.
Are we on the verge of being able to regrow lost body parts? Unless you're a salamander, which can regenerate whole chunks of itself, if you lose a limb or any complex part of your body for that matter, it's not going to grow back. But that doesn't mean it can't. The cells of our bodies have, as Michael Levin from Tufts University puts it, got the collective know-how for doing this. It's just a question of telling them to use it rather than reverting to the default option, which is to seal up a wound with a scar. After all, our entire bodies built themselves inside the space of just 40 weeks from a single fertilised egg. So can we reactivate certain parts of that same developmental programme to put ourselves right? In frogs at least, Michael Levin now thinks he can.
We have in our lab discovered certain signals, triggers, in particular bioelectric ones, that kickstart very complex downstream programs such as making eyes and brains and other things. And so our goal is to identify these triggers that convince the cells to go to a regeneration route as opposed to a scarring route.
In this instance, you were looking at limb regeneration in an amphibian. So talk us through what you actually did. What would happen if you didn't intervene, and what actually happened when you did?
So we chose the frog Xenopus laevis. This is a frog species that's used for a lot of work in immunology and cancer and developmental biology and neuroscience. And we used adult animals. So these are very large frogs. They do not regenerate proper legs back if they're lost. And what we wanted to do was to provide two things. We wanted to provide a localized microenvironment to the wound. So control very tightly the environment around that wound site to convince these cells that they were in a safe circumstance that they could go on to regenerate, and then provide some drugs which would activate certain pathways that would shift that decision point towards regeneration. And so there's a thing called a bioreactor, which contains a silk-based gel, which carries some of the drugs that is fit onto the amputation wound. It stays on for just 24 hours, and the leg growth is apparent well over a year after that process.
So if you just removed a limb from one of these animals normally, they would get very little regeneration, but you put this silk-soaked cocktail onto the wound site just for a day, and then you get something that continues to develop for a year.
Correct. Normally, at best, what they would make is this little flap of tissue that is quite soft. It has no feeling to it. It has no ability to be used for to support weight or anything like that. It's just this little flap of tissue. When you confront these cells with a bioreactor carrying these drugs in the first 24 hours, you trigger a very lengthy and very complex patterning process that results in lots of new tissue growth, bone growth, nerve growth, blood vessels, and ultimately a pretty good limb that is functional. It's both sensitive to touch and it's motile. The animal can use it to get around.
How does the leg know how big the frog is? In other words, it's going to grow. It's going to keep growing for a year. So how does it know when to stop?
That's an outstanding question that is actually very poorly understood. It's the same question as asking, how do the cells of a frog know how big the frog should be in the first place in order to make the frog during embryogenesis? Frankly, we still don't really understand that.
And the growth does stop. It's not you're going to end up with a giant leg with a little frog attached at the end of this. It does actually make a frog-sized matched replacement body part.
That's correct. The body part is absolutely scaled properly to the rest of the tissue. Yeah.
And have you taken this beyond frogs yet? Because we know that many of the factors that make these sorts of things happen in frogs. They exist in us as well, don't they? So have you now started to try this on more complicated, higher animals to see if the same can occur?
Yes, that's exactly our next steps. We have a spin-off company called Morpheceuticals, Inc., whose mission is to try to take this technology towards a point where someday it will be useful for therapeutics in human patients. And we are just beginning now work in mammalian models.
What about if you come back to people that had their injury years ago? Because in this instance, you make the injury. While the wound is fresh, you apply the bioreactor to it for that 24-hour period. What would happen if you went back to a frog that lost a limb a year ago? Would actually the window have closed by then? It's too late.
It's a good question. We don't know because we haven't done it yet, but I don't believe it would be too late. I think at worst, you might have to reopen a cut surface there. But I think the fundamentals which make this possible are still there. In other words, you still have cells there that have all of the information needed to know what a correct frog looks like. And all of these cells are constantly undergoing maintenance and keeping that frog together, despite the fact that individual cells are always aging and dying and keeping cells from turning cancerous and so on. That type of homeostasis, that ability of these cells to continue to work together towards maintaining a good organism, is always there. And I think that once we really crack some of the big scientific questions here, we would be able to trigger that even long after the original injury.
Michael Levin from Tufts University, and you can read how he did the work he was describing in the journal Science Advances. Well, now to another way to repair the body and a breakthrough in sight restoration. A new bionic eye system has been successfully implanted in a patient in the UK. The recipient was a woman with a condition called age-related macular degeneration, which progressively robs victims of their central vision, which greatly reduces quality of life. Julia Ravey spoke to eye surgeon Mahi Muket, who performed the implant surgery, to hear how he did it.
At Murfield's last week, there was a patient who I had implanted an electronic chip in December, and her eye had settled from the operation. So she has a condition called dry age-related macular degeneration, where she's missing the very center of the eye in a particularly large area. So there isn't any treatment for this. So our clinical trial is looking to implant a device that essentially replaces the light-sensitive cells in that part of the eye. And the good news was that the electronic chip was working 100%. And she actually was very quick to pick up how to use the system.
How does this bionic eye implant work?
So it's a pair of glasses that the patient wears. There is a small video camera, and it captures about 50 to 40 degrees. That is then passed from the glasses down to a small pocket computer that sits on the patient's waist, and then that can be tuned, and that then sends a much cleaner image to the glasses. The signals are then beamed using near-infrared light inside the eye, directly over the actual electronic chip. It's about the thinness of a human hair, so it's very, very tiny. And we have these specialized technicians that will help her to use the device and start to scan her visual world.
Why is it electrical signals that get sent to this chip?
It's a bit like solar panels. So out in the desert, you may see these cells called photovoltaic cells. That's a technical term, but they're essentially small electrodes, they're little cells. So the electronic chip has 378 of these small electrodes. They're called pixels. The near-infrared light from the glasses is beamed onto the chip that then charges up these small electrodes to start working. You then have little currents that run through the chip, and then the tissue surrounding the chip inside her retina starts to pick up these signals, and then they start to work, and then the network kicks off, and all the human function inside the eye helps to take these signals, process them, and they go down the optic nerve to the brain. Imagine you're looking at something, you know, like a letterbox. You see it upright, you see it in the right direction. That's to do with all the processing inside the eye, because if you didn't have that, it might be lying on its side or upside down. So what we find with the chip is that patients are able, in a previous trial, to see everything in the right orientation. So that's due to the processing. So that's the chip working with the cells of the eye.
Amazing. So it's sort of for the cells that are missing, it's plugging that gap and allowing you to still patch in the signal to the brain.
Exactly, yeah.
How clear is the vision that you get from it? So if I was looking at an eye chart, what line would I be able to read if I had this chip in place?
From seeing just shadows, they were able to recognize individual letters, and they were also able to scan words. So if you imagine a patient that has no vision in the center, it's completely dark, they're starting to pick up words and letters. We anticipate that perhaps they could pick up about two lines on the chart, but it's such a small study that now the European study will look at lots of different people in lots of different countries, and then you put all the results together, and that will give you a much better, more accurate result from the trial.
You mentioned that there's trials going on now for using this chip. What more needs to be done before the technology is more widely rolled out?
So the first one was what's called a first in humans. So you put the device into patients to actually see if it worked. And then once you know it's safe, you run them over a much larger group of patients, and then you follow them up during the study. So it's a 3-year study. So the results usually come out towards the end of the study period. And at that point, people are then preparing the next steps. So once we see the results already, the next step's being planned.
It really does sound like life-changing technology. How do you think devices like this will change the field of sight restoration?
Well, I think for this particular condition, where you probably read there is no treatment available, lots of treatments have tried, have failed. If you can restore some form of vision for a patient who is essentially blind in that eye, it can give a significant improvement in the quality of life.
And we will keep an eye on the progress of that very exciting technique in the months ahead. That was Mahi Muket. He was speaking with Julia Ravey. You're on 5 Live Science. I'm Chris Smith. And still to come, we're going to look at how you can lose and possibly regain your sense of smell and taste. But first, filters for your home drinking water system can be very pricey. So how about this idea to grow your own at home in the kitchen? It turns out that the floating culture that sits on top of your fermenting kombucha tea drink makes an excellent homemade water purification device. These microbial rafts are called SCOBYs, or symbiotic cultures of bacteria and yeasts. Basically, as the microorganisms grow making the tea drink, they lay down this fibrous meshwork that can subsequently be used, a bit like a coffee filter, to screen out things smaller even than bacteria from the water supply. And because they're full of living microbes, they can self-repair and even unclog themselves. So what's not to like? Tricia Smith asked Catherine Zudreau to take her through the concept, starting with what these things look like under the microscope.
It is primarily biocellulose. It basically looks like little fibers or threads, matted and intertwined, not really in any sort of pattern. And you can also see the bacteria. They're mostly acetobacter that make those little biocellulose threads. The most similar material that I can think of is kind of a wet seaweed, but it's pretty robust. It's pretty strong. You can handle it very easily. You can't tear it easily. You have to use scissors to cut it. So it's a very robust, but kind of slimy, slippery, flat sheet.
And when you're using these SCOBY membranes for water filtration, do you process them or are they just ready to use?
The really cool thing and the thing that I find so exciting about this research is that you can use them as is. So we tend to grow pretty thin SCOBYs, 1 to 2 millimeters thick. You can use them without killing off the bacteria or yeast. They're perfectly fine organisms to drink if they did get into the water. But if you leave them in there, there's actually some benefits from the water treatment process. Because if you do have the bacteria still alive in your membrane, they can help heal the membrane if you get, you know, a little cut or a little tear in it. And they can also assist with preventing clogging by other bacteria that might try to come in and live on the membrane.
Have you compared the performance of these membranes made from SCOBYs, these living filtration membranes, to ones that are typically used in water treatment now?
We have. And what we saw was that the living filtration membranes always seem to perform a little better than the commercial membranes. And by that, I mean that there were less bacteria that accumulated on the surface of the living filtration membranes. And so the water flowed more easily.
Do you think that living filtration membranes are more accessible to regions of the world where water filtration is still a problem than conventional polymer membranes?
I think that they potentially could be. you know, from a kind of a safety and ethical standpoint, at this particular time, I wouldn't go out, you know, somewhere where they didn't have easy access to water filtration and say, hey, just grow these. But I think that potentially could be done. You know, this is literally something that you can grow in your kitchen. All you need is water, some black tea, sugar, some vinegar, and then the culture itself. So yeah, I think that with, you know, a little more research, it could be a form of accessible water treatment.
Imagine that, a water filter that you can grow in your kitchen, and you get a bonus kombucha as well. Tricia Smith was speaking with Catherine Zudrow there, and that research was published in Environmental Science and Technology Water. You might have missed it, but it is in fact the end of Veganuary. Perhaps you even gave it a go, substituting all those meat dishes for some vegetable-based alternatives. We keep hearing how bad the meat industry is for the climate, but has the substitute meat industry actually made any difference? Harry Lewis is down at his local shop to find out.
We've probably all seen it over the past decade or so. These substitutes, or not necessarily even substitutes, just vegetable alternatives, have become pretty commonplace. And it feels like more and more of the aisle is being handed over to them. One person that does know if this increase in product is having an impact on the market is Stacey Payette from Wageningen University. She's the program manager of Proteins for Life.
That phenomenon that you have observed is pretty common across most of Western Europe, North America right now. In almost all of those countries, we're seeing growth upwards of 8% year on year in this category, which is extraordinary for the food market.
Yeah, it seems massive for this industry, 8%. Do we know where that extra food is going? Obviously, for those replacements in particular, the intention is to take over the market from meat. Do we see a correlation in a reduction of meat consumption as these different brands increase in their sales?
Not yet, is my answer. We're not seeing a corresponding decline in meat consumption across those countries where we're seeing an increase in sales in the plant-based alternatives yet.
Why aren't we seeing that correlation? What is happening? Is there just more food on the market?
Well, for one thing, I think these products are still filling a niche. So if we look at the global protein market, these alternatives are growing fast, but from a small starting point. So they represent less than 2% of the global market right now. And then, you know, the next question is, how are people using these products? And the hope, of course, is that you're going to use a plant-based burger to replace a meat burger. But we just don't know yet if that's what's happening.
Do we have any theories as to the patterns of consumption that are going on behind closed doors?
We do have some theories. There's one possibility, which is what we call the halo effect. And we know that from for example, the energy transition, that we might be sort of overcompensating and rewarding ourselves in a way that negates the good effect. For example, if you bought energy saving light bulbs, you might think to yourself, well, in that case, I can just take my car and drive back and forth to the supermarket because I'm saving over here. And what we tend to do is overcompensate or over reward ourselves. It's possible that that's happening here, that people are taking, for example, a meatless Monday, but at Friday evening, they're taking a double portion of meat to compensate. Another option is that there are genuinely people who are reducing their meat consumption, in one segment of society, but another segment of society that is, overcompensating or actually increasing their meat consumption, and that is sort of balancing it out. And for that reason, we're not seeing the decline show up.
Food for thought there from Harry Lewis. This is 5 Live Science. I'm Chris Smith. And for the rest of the show this week, Harry and Julia have another tasty topic to get their teeth into.
We're taking a deep dive into how your smell and taste work. We'll be hearing from someone who suffers from a condition called phantosmia, how we can normalise smell training, and maybe we'll get a spoonful of scientific cooking workarounds designed for those suffering from smell and taste disorders. To get us started, it's Harry Lewis.
The festivities of the Christmas period are well and truly over. It almost feels criminal to bring them up again. But I'm sure you can easily recall the indulgent spreads and generous glasses of bubbly. It's a good thought, isn't it? Well, for a growing subsection of the population, it might not be. Since the start of the coronavirus pandemic, more and more people have been left with a distorted sense of smell and taste. Out of our five senses, these two definitely seem to rank as the least important, and research is fairly limited in comparison to, let's say, eyesight. 2 years on from the initial spread of the virus, what do we know about these mysterious disorders? I've come to Future Dreams House in King's Cross to have a good nose at our senses with Barry Smith, Professor of Philosophy at the University of London and co-director of the Centre for the Study of the Senses.
So I think we need to start with the idea that, you know, we all enjoy food and we all enjoy eating, but what happens when eating goes wrong? What happens when you can't get the experience, the enjoyment out of food? And that can happen for a number of reasons. Now, we all know about COVID has very often left people with no sense of smell. And when they lose the sense of smell, they suddenly realize how big a contribution that was to tasting the flavors in food, because all the tongue will give them is salt, sweet, sour, bitter, savory, umami. But everything else, you know, pineapple, mango, melon, the difference between chicken and pork, that's all coming from the nose.
As Barry alluded to, smell and taste can be affected by a diverse range of conditions and circumstances. You might find it surprising to hear that head injuries, dementia, and even chemotherapy treatments can result in a lasting alteration to our sense of smell. And it's our nose that does some of the really heavy lifting when it comes to exploring flavour, as Barry explains.
Now, when we're eating food, we're using our tongue to get taste, we're using our nose to get the smell and aromas of food, and we're also using this other thing, the trigeminal nerve. That's the fifth facial nerve that serves the eyes, the nose, and the mouth, and it's the one that rings bells when you have too much wasabi, and you feel it at the bridge of your nose. Ow! Now, sometimes when people are undergoing treatment, that's completely muted, and we saw that with COVID too, that people said, I could eat a whole jar of mustard and no tingle, no response. But what we're now seeing is that people recovering from smell loss have a week or two where they think the sense of smell is restored and normal, and then they're developing this very, very disturbing condition called parosmia. And parosmia is the distortion of familiar smells, so that things you liked, like coffee or chocolate, now become disgusting. I mean, really, really disgusting. Best description I've had from a patient of how coffee is with parosmia is, it's like fruity sewage. Now, nobody's going to have that.
So if somebody else is sat at home right now and they're listening and they think to themselves, I think I'm suffering from this, what are those flavours that are likely? What are the patterns of those flavours that are likely to be affected? All those food or drink items.
We know that it's coffee. We know it's roasted meats. It's onions, garlic, eggs, even toothpaste, surprisingly enough, minty toothpaste. So a lot of people have switched to cinnamon-flavored toothpaste. Cinnamon seems okay. So by finding out which foods are really unpleasant, we learn which are the trigger foods and which are the safe foods.
Someone who has been figuring out those safe foods all by herself is Claire. When I spoke to her, she did tell me that her condition differs slightly from the symptoms described by Barry.
Yes, so Christmas Eve last year, myself and my partner both tested positive for COVID. It was a little bit frustrating because we had basically been sort of living like hermits for the sort of previous 8 weeks. And it's kind of changed my life, really. If you'd have said, fast forward a year, I'd have been in this position. I would never have believed you.
And what is that position? What is it that resulted after COVID?
I realised that sort of my smell and taste had departed, and I'd kind of hang on to the hope of the 6 to 8 weeks that everybody was telling me that it would bounce back. But as I've gone past each milestone, actually, it's now 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, and I'm kind of 2 weeks away from it being a year, or just under 2 weeks.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are in that situation where they lost their sense of smell and their sense of taste and it returned. But for you, something different happened, didn't it?
So they term it as phantosmia. So I've ended up having a smoke smell that can come on via a headache, and it'll be with me 24/7 for a week, 2 weeks. It'll wake me up in the middle of the night. It'll make my eyes water. So when I'm on sort of Zoom calls or Teams calls with meetings, it's kind of a little bit embarrassing because it can look like I'm about to start crying. You know, the number of things I've burnt both on the hob and in the grill, it's in the tens. So I don't leave anything unattended because you just can't smell it. So, it is frustrating.
alongside this phantom smell, Claire also experiences the symptoms of parosmia. Out of curiosity, I asked what she missed the most.
Lots of things, really. Just being able to sort of smell my home, being able to sort of smell the outdoors if you go outside. I can't sort of smell my partner because we all have sort of, you know, if you put sort of bath shave on. I miss all sorts of food. I can't eat meat. Yeah, there's just all sorts.
Coffee.
I haven't had a coffee now for a year. I long to have a latte. I'd love to have a nice Costa latte, but I can't because it just, when the coffee machine is going downstairs, I have to hold my nose because it makes me gag. So I don't know what it is about coffee and chocolate. Chocolate, I miss the creaminess of a bar of chocolate, a galaxy bar of chocolate, just to be able to get depth. So yeah, I can't get any depth in any food. It's so frustrating.
Claire, it sounds like you're speaking of a lot of people's worst nightmares there, really.
The Naked Scientists on 5Live.
For the rest of the programme this week, Julia Ravey and Harry Lewis from our team are investigating taste and tackling the question, how are taste and smell different?
Here to help us answer those types of questions is Carl Philpott. He's Professor of Rhinology and Olfactory at University of East Anglia, and he also established the first UK smell and taste clinic. Carl, can we start off by trying to distinguish? I mean, is there a difference between taste and flavour?
Yes. So flavour is really the combination of smell and taste together, whereas taste, from a medical perspective, is simply what we experience from the tongue and the other locations of taste buds in the mouth and the throat.
And is there a way for us to do this in the studio, for us to distinguish between these two types of thing?
Absolutely, yes. So we can do something called the Skittle test.
I have a big pack of Skittles here with me. Let me quickly hand one over to Julia as well whilst we're here. It'd be rude to leave her out, and that's for me.
Oh.
What do we do next, Carl?
Okay, so first thing is to pinch your nose so that there's no air flowing through your nose. And then when you've done that, you can place the Skittle inside your mouth.
Go on then, Junior. In that goes. Yeah.
And let it sit there for 5 to 10 seconds just to sort of start dissolving and get an idea of what it is you're tasting.
I mean,
sugar.
Sugar, yeah.
It's sweet, very, isn't it? Very specific to one part of my tongue as well.
If you release your hand from your nose to let the air flow through your nose.
Oh,
you should now experience what's the flavour of the sweeters.
I've been waiting to eat these all show as well, Carl, so suddenly I'm getting that blueberryness come through and it's fantastic. What about you, Julia?
Yeah, the orange is there.
It's
strong.
Around the whole mouth as well. That's what I'm experiencing. It's not just on the tongue, but it's actually kind of coating the inside of my mouth.
So what's happening now is you've got a process that we call retronasal olfaction taking place, and that's basically the smell of the food inside your mouth and you're breathing it back out through your nose from the back of your mouth. So it's the reverse of when you sniff things from the outside.
And for people with parosmia, what's happening?
So for parosmia, obviously they're getting the same signal that you and I would get in normality, but the information as it's sort of picked up in the smell receptors is then being interpreted incorrectly. And we think that's largely because some of the smell receptors aren't working properly, so you're only getting part of the jigsaw. And it's always unpleasant generally, unfortunately. I don't know why that it's unpleasant, but it generally, a few people get a pleasant parosmia, but most people get unpleasant parosmia.
Now that you're saying a few people are getting it, how many people are we seeing since COVID began develop these symptoms? Is it a lot?
It is. So of the people who get infection with COVID-19, about 60% get smell and taste loss as a symptom. Of those, about 10 to 15% go on to have persistent symptoms that last more than 4 weeks. So if you multiply that by the number of infections we've had in the UK so far, we're talking somewhere close to 1 million people. And of those 1 million people, we think about 50% of those, based on the work of our global studies, are getting parosmia, this smell distortion, if you look at them 6 months on from the time of their original infection. Increasingly, we see more and more younger people and now children being affected by these smell disorders. And for the first time, I've been seeing teenagers in my clinic, which I've never seen teenagers with viral smell loss in the last 2 decades. So that's a really new phenomenon that COVID's produced.
How many are we talking about?
Well, I can only say really it's probably one or two a month at the moment. But given that, I'd never seen them before, that's quite significant. And also through our charity Fifth Sense, we get a lot of people getting in touch with the charity looking for support. And again, they're parents of children, and some are even under the age of 10. So it's surprising how young some of these people are that are being affected, which is incredible.
I wonder what people that are suffering can do. I know there's been a lot of talk about smelling oils, and I have a short clip of Claire again giving it a go at home.
One thing I've been doing since I lost my smell and taste, probably about 6 weeks in, is smell training. So I basically just purchased a set of 20 oils, essential oils, from Amazon. And effectively what I do is a couple of times a day, morning and evening, is just take short sniffs of each of the oils. I guess when I have bad weeks, I tend to not do it so often. And when I kind of feel a bit more focused, then I do sort of try it. The one thing I find sort of probably discouraging is that I rank the smells, the bottles in the box, based on how well I can smell them. And it's interesting, just over time, very few have moved up the scale. And most of them have largely stayed in the same ranking. For example, smells like bergamot, rosemary and ginger, I can't really smell in the essential oils. And then cinnamon, clove, eucalyptus and lemongrass are probably the strongest scents. I also wander around the house smelling things from the herb shelf. I'll smell sort of toiletries. And I guess I'll kind of, there are certain things I'll sort of keep smelling just to sort of check back in. And I must admit, I do get quite excited when I get a bit of a stronger smell, because the one thing I have noticed is there's not much depth in a lot of the smells. So when I do certainly find something that there's some depth in, the joy is just unbelievable. So, I just try and continue to do this as regular as I possibly can.
Carl, for those people that are suffering, is this something they should be doing, or is there certain treatments they can be doing at home?
So, yes, I mean, smell training's an established sort of rehabilitation technique that's had good evidence over the last 10 years. It doesn't work for everybody, but it's worth a try because it's simple to do. And the key message is you don't need to go out and buy anything expensive to do it. The things in your cupboard can be used to help you do it. And the central message is four things twice a day for 1 or 2 minutes. There should be things that you were familiar with before you had your problem. And you go to the Fifth Sense website, our charity's website, there's lots of information there about how you can go and do this on each simple and easy basis every day. And it's sticking with it. You've really got to stick with it for up to a year. In reality, the real studies show that the benefits come from longer term determination with the technique and changing the smells every 3 months.
Carl, Claire wants to know, she's been now with a altered sense of smell for a year. Is phantosmia something she's likely to have to live with for the rest of her life?
So these smell distortions like parosmia and phantosmia do tend to be self-limiting. There is a range, but they do tend to get better with time, so they tend to sort of fade out. I'm always talking to people about, once the problem's gone beyond 3 months and it's kind of looks like it's a fairly established problem, then it's worth sort of engaging with treatment, whatever that treatment that may be. The biggest problem we have in this field is that there's a real paucity of good quality clinical trials to underpin any treatment. So most of the things that have been tried have been done so in sort of studies that don't really have the sufficient scientific rigor. And that's one of the things I'm trying to correct with my work going forwards. So it does tend to get better, but it's pretty miserable while people are experiencing it.
And Cole, is there any other research that's on the horizon that people might be using for treatment in the future?
Yes. So we're just about to start a trial using vitamin A drops, and that's sort of a 3-month course of treatment. So we're looking sort of compared to a placebo to see if there are changes in the brain in the areas where smell signals are received as a consequence of doing so. And hopefully we'll take that into a further trial if that's successful.
And why vitamin A?
So it's thought the vitamin A, the retinoic acid component of vitamin A, is potentially involved in the DNA repair process, allowing the receptor cells to potentially regenerate.
Carl Philpott from University of East Anglia, thanks very much.
Smell is obviously a major part of our lives, and here to discuss why we take it for granted is the chair of the Global Consortium for Chemosensory Research and Assistant Director of Monell Chemical Senses Centre, Valentina Palmer. So circling around what Claire said earlier, I was surprised that the two things she misses before she even mentioned food were her house and her partner. What are the main things that smell is used for that we don't commonly think of?
That is a very good question and can be quite common among people who lose their sense of smell or experience distortion to notice these things for the first time. We can really think about the support of eating behavior and nutrition in general. So smell kind of tickles our appetite and allows us to appreciate, as Carl was saying, you know, all of the differences in the foods that we're eating and we are enjoying generally. The second big important function is warning and protection from hazards that we can find in the environment. Simple thing that may have happened to most of us. You have a carton of milk in the fridge. You don't know when exactly you opened it, and you use your nose to detect whether it is spoiled or not. And the third one, which may be the most surprising, is social communication. So imagine the odor of your partner, as Claire was saying. It's infused of some positive and familiar sensations of memories, like it's a calming effect. But social communication doesn't stop to mating and finding a partner and, you know, a good match in the modern world. But it also refers to newborns and mothers and, you know, bonding at the very early stages of life, because we do know that the sense of smell is one of the most functioning senses at birth and even prenatally. It's fully developed in utero.
Claire also mentioned, you know, how depressing it can be. And she said to Harry that before the pandemic, she was never anxious, but now she's prone to bouts of anxiety. Is that normal? Do a lot of people suffer from that?
Yeah, unfortunately it is. And the reason, you know, when we look at the brain and where the olfactory system is, then we also understand why. Because the olfactory system is tightly connected with the limbic system. And the connection in particular between these olfactory bulbs that I mentioned is linked with depressive symptoms. And so people then tend to have a reduction in the size of the olfactory bulb. They also tend to show more depressive symptoms. And we do see in people that improve their levels of depression, their olfactory abilities also increase back again. So we can see that there is a tight link in particular with depression.
We were wondering, is there any way in which she can help, you know, she can improve her mental health?
Self-compassion is a big part of this process. So like, keep working on your sensory training and keep, you know, monitoring your sense of smell so that you can detect like the tiniest changes in the positive direction. Know that you're not alone. There are plenty of other people, unfortunately, in your situation at the moment. And then give yourself a pat in the back, because you're doing, you know, you're putting a lot of effort in trying to improve this situation that, you know, if you had control over it, you would not be in.
And just briefly, is our ability to smell something that we should be paying closer attention to? And if so, how should we be monitoring it?
This is a very good question. Like, usually we do not think about our smell, as I mentioned, in our day. And so we saw this was very important in the COVID-19 pandemic. It took a long time to put like the sense of smell on, like among the symptoms to look for. And so with colleagues at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia, we developed a rapid test, the Sentinel, that helps us actually detect very quickly what is the function of different aspects of olfaction. Usually we think about, can I identify the odor that I'm smelling? But this is not everything that the olfactory system can do for us. And so we are using Sentinel with the idea in mind of proposing universal smell testing. I'm pretty sure that all of us, or most of us, have been tested for vision, for audition, at least once in our lives. But doctors, like any doctors, usually propose to us to do a smell test to check on our well-being and our health. So our idea at Monell is that having a smell test that is rapid, the Sentinel takes really 1 minute, 2 minutes. It's really fast. It's easy to do. People can do it on their own, can actually help us monitor like how the changes in our sense of smell. And this is going to be very helpful in detecting several diseases down the road.
So we actually have one of your Sentinel tests here, which allow you to monitor your sense of smell over time. And Harry is going to do a little live demo for us.
If I turn over my leaflet, there's three different squares and they each have a plastic peel over them. So I'm getting rid of them. And then I can actually, a bit like an old scratch and sniff book, start smelling the different boxes. And I'm getting told by the app to go through and label which one is the strongest. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to have a go at this, and at the end, I'll tell you my results. Thanks there to Valentina Palmer and her Sentinel smell test. We want to know how you alleviate some of the pressure when your senses aren't functioning as they once did.
Harry went to the Life Kitchens London base, a non-profit cookery school for people who've been affected by cancer or now COVID, to find out if there is a way of injecting some joy back into food.
Back now to Future Dreams House in King's Cross, a breast cancer support centre, to meet Ryan Riley from Life Kitchen in their specially kitted out showroom. Those new potatoes that you can hear gently simmering in the background will make an appearance slightly later on.
When I was 18 years old, my mother was diagnosed with small cell lung cancer, and I was her primary carer for 2 years. And there was just this moment towards the end of her life when treatment was really the only thing keeping her alive, where food just became a necessity, but not one that she cared to indulge in. All of the taste was gone. There's this famous story of us all at a family lunch where she bit into an onion, what she thought was an apple, and she couldn't tell the difference. It was that bad for her towards the end. And then at the same time, I met Professor Barry Smith, and there was just this element where I thought, I think if we launch something together, where we do a cookery class, it could be a really exciting moment to help someone rediscover their, you know, their love of food and that little bit of pleasure.
Ryan and Barry wanted to create somewhere or something that could help everyday people who are suffering with smell and taste related conditions to be able to find affordable everyday alternatives. They're workarounds. They won't restore the previously experienced flavours that have been lost, but they may allow those suffering to explore new ones.
One of the things that is always there is texture and temperature. And so again, this is something that Ryan has experimented with, contrasts in temperature, contrasts in textures. Those will still make what would otherwise be a very boring and dull eating experience a bit more interesting. And one of the things that really is the sort of major tool to use is the use of foods with umami. Umami is one of those tastes, basic tastes, along with salt, sweet, sour, bitter, which a lot of people in the West don't recognize. In Japan, umami would be as obvious as salt or sweet. You know, the dishes that have it, they can be mushrooms, they can be tomatoes, they can be Parmesan cheese. So there's a huge range of things. Think of soy sauce. That's that meaty taste that we get in it, which is not just saltiness, it's meatiness. And you get that in mushrooms, you get that in soy sauce. That is umami.
This loan word from Japanese is hard to translate directly into English, but suggested equivalents include savoury, essence, pungent, deliciousness, and meaty. Is also said to involve all the senses, with connotations of emotion and spirituality. One thing we can be certain of is that both Barry and Ryan are obsessed with it.
It's the one thing I will never stop talking about, because if you want to add more flavour to your food, whether you're living with cancer or COVID or any other reason, just get that umami hit in there. Add a bit of Marmite into your spaghetti bolognese. Add a bit of miso into your mayonnaise on a sandwich, an egg mayonnaise sandwich with some miso through that mayo just adds that real beautiful savoury kick and a touch more saltiness. And salt is often really demonised in life, but actually it's the difference between a good and a bad dish, and umami is the difference between a good dish and an excellent one.
And that being said, Ryan, that's what we're going to do right now. You've got a recipe lined up, we've got the potatoes in the pan, they've been bubbling away. What are we doing at the moment? What's in front of us?
See, this for me is my favourite dish in the whole book. It's called miso butter potatoes with green chilli vinegar. Now, when we were talking earlier about how you can't have recipes with garlic and onions at the core, that would scare most people. But actually, it's the key again. If you can add a base of umami-rich like beginnings, then you'll really kind of not miss the garlic and onion base. So for this, we've got some beautiful new potatoes, and they're lovely and hot. And then I've just drained them, going to drop them into the pan. And then we're going to do like a classic bit of cookery by just adding a lot of butter. It is really an important part. We're going to get some miso in there. Now, miso comes in so many different forms. It's brown, it's white, it's red. But what at the core is this beautiful like fermented soybean. And we might add a little bit more. The thing about cookery and the thing about when you've lost your sense of taste, we're looking at how you can adjust for personal preference.
So kind of forget the ingredients book, start from scratch and kind of go back to cooking at its core. You figure out what the guidelines are.
Yeah, Nigel Slater once said that a recipe you should cook once or twice and then you should go off on your own. Because if you get the basis in, you then realise what works for you. You know, both me and you standing here now have different tastes. So how can a recipe fit that? So you get that core and then suddenly you've got the basis. Just don't swap out the miso. And I'm just about to add a little bit of soy sauce and a little bit of pepper. So that's three types of umami already. And it's not like we've used anything that unusual. Smashing it down there just to really get those flavours in. So we're going to be moving on to this green chilli vinegar. And that again is playing into so many of our other senses. And it starts by chopping some coriander, parsley and mint.
In goes the chilli.
I'm going to get this into a bowl now. And now the favourite part here is we're going to use really cheap malt vinegar. So we've got all those herbs, we've got that vinegar.
In they go.
And I'm going in, we're using lots of it here. And I think we should serve this up.
I think we should serve it up, Ryan. Great idea.
We should, but I'm going to give you one warning. When we tested it, there was a lady who had COVID and her housemate didn't. She loved this dish and her housemate said it was so strong that it nearly blew her head off. Now, the thing for me is I love flavour. I love powerful, real amazing flavour-packed food. So I hope you can handle it.
I can't think of a time that I've ever tasted malt vinegar in that way and in that manner.
It adds to it.
I'm going
to
go in for
but
more.
It has blown your mind, right?
It's blown my mind.
I mean, it really was powerful. The team at Life Kitchen have put together a book of simple recipes designed around those who are burdened with parosmia but live in the usual fast-paced lifestyle that we're all used to. It's called Taste and Flavour, and it's free for all those who need it. You can download a digital copy online, which will also help fill you in on what's happening to your sense of smell and taste. Armed with this compact little recipe book, I went back to Claire and asked her to give one of the recipes a go for me.
So I tried the cherry and almond tartlet.
And we were chatting over text and it was because you fancied something sweet, didn't you?
Yes. Yeah.
And how did it work out?
The only thing I would say, I got the slightest hint of taste with the cherry. Yeah, while the syrup was cooking, I could sort of smell a little bit. You know, I could smell the orange coming out in it, and I thought, oh, this looked quite good. But yeah, the finished product, I could just taste a bit of the cherry. But my other half said it was really tasty, so it didn't really help. But, yeah.
And the results are in from our own Sentinel smell test in the studio. Harry?
Yeah, that's right. What I've had to do is I've had to say which of the three smells I have in front of me is strongest. I've then had to say how intense that smell is. And then I've been given selections on my mobile phone to try and identify it. On this occasion, I've got the answer right. So I was right. It does smell like oranges. It's pretty strong. So if you monitor that over time, see how the intensities change, you can basically see if your smell's deteriorating at any point in your life. Interesting stuff there from Valentina.
Thanks to Harry Lewis, Claire, Ryan and Barry helping to shed light on what it's like for those who lose their sense of smell and taste.
And of course, thanks to Carl and Valentina as well.
And that was Harry Lewis and Julia Ravey. That's it for this week, but Five Live Science is back at the same time next Sunday. And we're going to be posing the question, where did COVID come from? Was it a jump from a wild animal in a meat market? Or is COVID, as some are saying, an experiment that escaped from a lab? Join us next week when we look at what we do and perhaps more critically, what we still don't know about where COVID came from. If you'd like to get in touch in the meantime, our email address, fivelivescience@bbc.co.uk. Until then, from me, Chris Smith, thanks for listening and goodbye.
Have you just missed that amazing goal on Five Live?
Oh, what a goal! It's stuff that dreams are made of!
Download the BBC Sounds app and you'll never miss another moment. You can go back to the start of any live show or match. Pause the commentary mid-action and even rewind to hear it again and again.
Oh, what a goal!
Play, pause and rewind. Live radio that you control. Listen on BBC Sounds.